Your Turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's Your Turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Thursday edition of It's Your Turn. Thursday, August 1st, believe it or not. Wow. Where's the summer going, huh? Hey, we got a lot of summer left. We got a lot of good stuff coming up. My goodness, this weekend we've got the regatta at Lake Arthur, Marine State Park Regatta. Next week, all week long, we've got the farm show. Got a lot of stuff to look forward to. But there is that little pang whenever you change the calendar to August. It's an Ask the Lawyer Day today, and we are very pleased to welcome here to our studio local attorney Delia Bianchin. Delia, nice to have you here today.
Thanks, David. Nice to be here.
You are with the Lynch Law Group, and where are the offices of the Lynch Law Group?
We're in Cranberry Township, just about a mile north of 228, right off of Route 19.
Have you been with them for a while, Delia?
This is my third year.
Oh, excellent. Are you from this area originally?
I actually grew up in South Beaver Township, and after having spent 8 years in Grand Rapids, Michigan, moved back to Pittsburgh to go to law school and lived there for many years, and my first 10 years of practice were downtown Pittsburgh, and I joined Penn United as their corporate counsel about 14 years ago.
Well, everybody here knows Penn United Technologies down there on the Route 356.
Yeah, served there.
Freeport Road.
Yeah, served there for 10 years, and after moving on from there, joined the Lynch Law Group, like I said, just about 3 years ago.
You focus a lot on commercial and corporate law.
That's correct.
And I assume that that's what you've done a lot of ever since you really started your practice.
Yep. I did 10 years of complex commercial litigation in my first 10 years. I was with the big firms downtown Pittsburgh. And then I spent 10 years as general counsel of Penn United and addressed a whole wide range of commercial and corporate matters that would come to bear with the company. And then now it's nice to be able to use both of those types of experiences for the small and medium-sized businesses that I work with now.
Mm-hmm. Are there several attorneys in the Lynch Law Group?
Or? Yeah, there's 19 of us now.
Oh, wow.
And again, we've been a boutique business firm for many years, but quite frankly, with some of the more recent expansion, I'd say it's more accurate to say we're a full-service firm and serving attorneys largely in, you know, this area, we also have an office in South Point as well.
When you say boutique firm, that might be a term that's not familiar to a lot of folks. What's that mean?
I guess when I'm using it, I'm thinking that we're a firm that has sort of a high level of expertise in areas specific to businesses, again, small to medium-sized businesses, though we also serve larger businesses. The profile of a lot of the attorneys that are with the Lynch Law Group are folks like me that had started their career at large law firms, and for various reasons, for me, it's lifestyle. I've got two young kids, have decided to move to a smaller firm environment.
Now, do companies, and I suppose this differs from company to company, but do they sign contracts with the attorneys to represent them on a regular basis, or do they just come to you on a case-by-case basis, or both?
It's both. It's both. Though I would say I have a lot of clients where I basically serve almost like their outside general counsel. You know, they don't have, they're not of such a size that it can justify them having an attorney as a full-time employee with the business, so that we're on retainer and, you know, there to answer questions as they come up. But other scenarios, you may have a company that engages you just for a specific project. Maybe it's a specific piece of litigation, again, or maybe just an issue that client is facing at that time.
Now, could this be, for example, hypothetical example is all we're talking about here, because, as you know, whenever we chat with the professionals, whether it's attorneys or physicians or financial advisors or whatever, we're certainly not giving specific advice. We're speaking in the broad sense, and, you know, anyone that's looking for specific information should consult with their own advisor or attorney. But might a situation be where a company is sued by someone or some other company, and then they would need counsel as to how to proceed?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it may be a commercial matter. Say it might be a supplier dispute or a vendor dispute. It may be a dispute with a company and its customer. And, you know, it may be an employment-related matter where you have a current or a former employee who's filed claims or litigation against a company. There's a wide range of issues where that could come up.
Many of these cases don't make the headlines. They don't make the news. But I suspect that there are a lot of cases that we don't hear about, right, that are kind of under the radar.
Absolutely. And I would say particularly in the type of work that I do, a lot of which is advice and counseling to small, medium-sized businesses regarding scenarios that they face, you would certainly not want them. Your goal would be in part to make sure it never makes the news, mm-hmm. and that you're able to navigate how to make the best decisions to move forward effectively to resolve things. And maybe you need to make adjustments to your policies and procedures to take into account changes in the law. That often comes up as well.
Do you deal very much in contracts?
Absolutely. Yeah. I would say the huge part of my work over the years relates to contract drafting, contract negotiation, and at times the contract enforcement. And it's not for everybody, but I will say for me, it's always been a passion. When I started law school, I thought that I would want to do child advocacy work. And during my law school experience, I ended up working at a clinic and handling a lot of family law and child advocacy related issues. And I found it to be very emotionally challenging and draining, and was surprised to find that in my contracts class, I absolutely loved it, and again, in a way that I wouldn't have expected. And again, it's probably not for everybody, but I really do love when I'm able to get a contract terms and conditions accurately reflecting, capturing the important legal concepts, but put in a way that folks can understand and help parties reach a meeting of the minds for that particular issue.
I've talked with a number of attorneys who focus a lot and have focused a lot on family law, and that's one thing I've always wondered about, because there are really some emotionally charged situations there. You know, whether you're dealing with child custody or child support or divorce or that sort of thing, it can get tough to handle sometimes, I would think.
Yeah.
From an attorney standpoint.
Absolutely.
Certainly from the litigant's standpoint as well.
Though I must say, in the litigation context and even in the business context, it's hard to get away because, of course, we're dealing with people in their everyday lives. You can't get away from that emotional component. Mm-hmm. And I guess the divorces, quote unquote, that I work with would be in the business context, right? Folks have gone into business together and period of time has gone by. Maybe they've worked well together for many years, but here we are 10 years, 15 years down the road, and things aren't going well, and you're working through those individuals how to, basically it's a business divorce, you know, how
to. I never thought about it in those terms, but as soon as you mentioned it, I said, yes, I can see where that would be a problem. And in some cases, many cases, these would have been good friends, maybe even relatives who started a business together and then decided to separate, and a ton of issues there,
right.
Huh?
Yep, and you absolutely cannot get away from the emotions, that's for sure, in that context.
Now, when you get a situation like that, what's the process? I mean, is it somewhat analogous to criminal law, where you kind of sit down and you try to get the, what do they call it, the findings of fact or something like that?
I think in this context, one of the most important things is to find out what that company has done, what they have in place in terms of their corporate governance documentation. So when they formed the business in the outset or over the years, did they take the time to put together either a shareholder agreement or an operating agreement that outlined how it is they would handle a scenario if they had a disagreement? Unfortunately, a lot of companies, especially I would say smaller companies, didn't take that time and didn't make that investment up front, which makes the wind up that much more challenging. If you had, like, for example, if it was a limited liability company and they had an operating agreement, they spelled out in that operating agreement how they would handle things if one of the members wanted to leave or dissociate. Mm-hmm. Then it's just a matter of you read the provisions, you trigger that provision, you follow the process that's outlined there. If that operating agreement, for example, may spell out a process for determining the value, right, of the company for that time. If that's not defined, then it's a matter of looking to the statutory law, the business corporation law, or the limited liability statutes. And it just gets more complicated. You know, you typically end up in litigation if you don't have clear corporate governance documentation in place.
Business and corporate law. I'm guessing that's a pretty big book.
It's a pretty big book. It is. It is. And, you know, what I often say as I encourage companies to take that time and put, for example, an operating agreement or a shareholder agreement in place that reflects what they would want to have happen. Mm-hmm. What I encourage them is if you don't have the agreement, it doesn't mean that you don't have a whole bunch of rules that you're going to need to follow. You just don't know what they are, right? And that's one thing where with the business corporation law, companies, individuals have a lot of flexibility to sort of set their own rules. But that's only, again, if they take that opportunity to engage in that way.
I'm guessing that, I don't have any experience in this area, I'm guessing that especially for some small business, maybe many small businesses who got started years and years ago, it was more or less a handshake, between two parties or among even more than two parties, and they started rolling. And then years or even decades later, something that started with a handshake might be a little bit difficult to unravel.
Yeah. Dave, I think you're exactly right. I mean, that's what we see. I think that happens a lot now. You know, folks decide to go into business together. You know, even initial funding at the outset of a business, the start of a business, is often done in a handshake. Now, of course, if a bank's involved, the bank's going to have their documentation. But mm-hmm. Private loans, again, we often see that. It's just a handshake. And there's nothing wrong with that. Again, as long as folks are in agreement about how to proceed, I would particularly encourage anybody if we form a business for somebody, we encourage them and work with them to set up those corporate governance documents right at the outset. But if not, you also want to check in on it, make sure that it continues to reflect what it is you want. In terms of that corporate governance as time goes on. So at the beginning of the business, say it's two partners, and then over time you've added two more. It's really important to make sure you're looking at that document and imagining, if you think about it, not only like how is it that you're going to make decisions about running that business on a day-to-day basis, but how is it that you're going to resolve any disputes and who has what authority? It's really critical, again, to check in on that periodically and make sure that your documents still reflect what it is the parties want.
I guess it's similar to, from an individual person standpoint, to making a will. You meet with an attorney, make a will, and then every so often it's good to review that. Mm-hmm. Circumstances change. People get married, people get divorced, people die, and you might want to review that and make sure that everything still applies.
That's
right?
An excellent point, and I think that's a really good analogy, Dave. We have a great estates and trust department with the Lynch Law Group, and they do a lot in terms of updating people's wills or trust documentation. The other thing, if we're talking about this topic, it's so important for folks to pay attention to their beneficiary forms and make sure for any retirement accounts that they have set up that they update those periodically. My husband and I had our daughter for 3.5 years before our son came along, and you got to make sure you have it updated that it reflects all the children you have, for mm-hmm. example, mm-hmm. or
in the case of a divorce, you want to make sure that the appropriate beneficiary is on the dotted line, even for insurance beneficiaries.
Absolutely. It's so critical. And again, that's one area where people often, and the heartbreak is the scenarios we've gotten pulled in to look at, even when I have assisted companies that have the scenario where you're like, the beneficiary form is still identifying the former spouse, and you're thinking, that that's probably not what that person wanted, but they didn't update their beneficiary forms, and that causes a lot of problems for the family.
Is there any way, it's a little bit parenthetical, but is there any way to get out of that under Pennsylvania law?
It would be a very complicated process, and some of our orphans court judges would ultimately make that determination, so I wouldn't want to say it carte blanche. But let's put it this way, it's an uphill battle, and I would not be too terribly optimistic that you would prevail.
If you're just joining us, and a lot of folks do that sometimes when we're midstream through the program here, especially if you just jumped into the car and turned on the radio, who's on with Dave today? It's Delia Bianchin. She is a local attorney, and she's with the Lynch Law Group. Their offices are in Cranberry Township. And Delia focuses a lot in her work on corporate and commercial law and also employment law. And it's interesting to learn a little bit about this. I don't know a whole heck of a lot, but I've already learned quite a bit. And I hope that you have, too. So let's take a break here. We'll continue our conversation with Delia here on It's Your Turn in just a moment. One of our sponsors on the program today, the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler. They started a couple of weeks ago now with their Saturday morning collections of excess garden produce. So those of you who are backyard gardeners or back porch gardeners, if you have a little bit of excess come the end of the week, consider donating those items to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank. Now, they don't want everything out of your garden, but whenever you and your family have had enough and you've given some tomatoes to the neighbors and to Aunt Bessie and everybody else, and you still have some left over, don't let it go to waste. Yeah, donate to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank. They make it very easy. They really do. Every Saturday morning from now, and this will be through September, they'll have people from 8 a.m. until 12 noon at St. Michael's Social Hall. It's right behind St. Michael's Church on Center Avenue on Butler's south side. They'll be there. You drop off your stuff on a Saturday morning, and it'll be distributed to needy families on Monday through the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank. And for the families, this is great, because a lot of the stuff that they get from the food bank is non-perishable items. It has to be that way so that they can store it on their shelves. Fresh, local garden produce, what a treat. They've done this program for several years. It's been a great success. So think about it. If you've got a few extra tomatoes or peppers or whatever, you'll feel better about it, and you'll certainly be helping a good cause. They like to say at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul that we stand tallest when we stoop to help others. Good thought. Hey, another message, and we'll be back with more right after these words.
That frightening sound is one we hear quite often throughout the day. Our heart quickens, and immediately we wonder what happened. A medical emergency can be frightening. Every tick of the clock crucial. And that's why Butler Ambulance Service is dedicated to be there with every ounce of care possible. Butler Ambulance Service is within minutes of providing you or a loved one with treatment and transportation. Call 282-9595 to find out more. Butler Ambulance Service is a phone call away from serving you.
my good friends. It's the Thursday edition of It's Your Turn. It's an Ask the Lawyer Day. We always like to tip our hat to Janice Hackett at the Butler County Bar Association because she helps us to organize this program. We do it on a periodic basis throughout the year. And we're talking today to Delia Bianken, who is a lawyer, local lawyer with the Lynch Law Group in Cranberry. And her work, actually, for most of your career, hasn't it, has focused a lot on corporate and commercial law. I suppose one of the things that makes it difficult for the average person or the average businessman to comprehend would be the maze of government regulations that you have to follow.
Yeah.
When you're, even if it's a simple incorporation, right?
Right. Yeah.
You got to dot the right I's and cross the right T's. Huh?
Yeah. And particularly depending what area of law, again, the level of regulatory requirements can be quite extensive. And employment law is one good example. There's a whole wide range of federal statutes, and there's often the state sort of sister components, and then often even municipal acts or laws that could come into place that outline rules and restrictions with respect to employment law matters that, and, you know, a lot of times those statutes regulate the sort of behavior that it would be common sense, but that isn't always the case. So, yeah, that's one area where there's a lot of regulatory authority that it's good to be and make sure you stay abreast of.
I guess I've not thought a whole lot about this, but when you're talking about hiring procedures, interviewing procedures, I've always heard that you're not specifically allowed to ask anybody how old they are. Is that correct?
It's generally a bad idea. There's
how old are you anyway? You can't do that when you're interviewing someone.
It's just
right?
Generally not a good idea. You don't want to ask questions or raise issues about any of the protected classes, and age is one of them. You want to make sure that it's not at all apparent or gives the impression that you're making judgments based on somebody's age. Mm-hmm. That is something that is restricted. It's not permitted.
The reason that I mention this, and this is one area, we were talking earlier on the program, that a lot of the work you do doesn't make headlines. You don't hear about it on the news. But one thing that you do hear about on the news is when someone is terminated, and then they will start litigation against the company claiming that it was age discrimination.
Yeah.
That they were terminated because they were getting too old. This makes the news quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah. And it's an area of focus for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. That's at the federal level. At the state level, it's the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission. So again, making sure that decisions are not being made by age is something that the regulatory authorities are paying close attention to.
What about gender? This is something that a few years ago you wouldn't even think about considering, but we just had a story in the news today, as a matter of fact, that PennDOT will soon give people who are getting or renewing their driver's license, people who decline to check either male or female on their driver's license will have the opportunity to respond X, a gender-neutral response.
Yeah.
Now, that's if you're getting a driver's license. I don't know whether that's a concern about employers who are hiring people or not, but it probably will be before too much longer.
Yeah. It has long since been important in hiring decisions to not base your decision based on gender, or maybe I should say sex, that's the language in Title VII.
Mm-hmm.
And that plays a part in throughout the employment arrangement, employment relationship. So from hiring to terms and conditions during employment, or even how termination decisions are made, the employer is not permitted to consider the sex of the employee in that context. And it extends to the harassment claims. You often hear about sexual harassment, sex-based harassment. And again, it's been well-settled law for a long time that even in a same-sex scenario, that harassment in the workplace is not permitted. And I think that falls in the category of something that strikes you more as common sense. You know, people are entitled to be treated with dignity and respect at work.
But these were issues that, you know, you don't have to go back too many years before it wasn't a concern. Sexual orientation would be an issue here as well, in addition to the harassment. And I'm sure that there are regulations in that area as well, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I think it all comes down to the fact that people are entitled to be treated with respect and dignity at work. And, you know, it's kind of like, let's focus on the job and not get distracted by other conditions that shouldn't really be relevant to the discussion.
Are there diversity regulations that apply? I speak specifically, for example, with regard to ethnicity.
Yeah, particularly for certain government-related work, there are often requirements to have an affirmative action plan, for example, in order to participate in certain government contracting. You may need to put an affirmative action plan in place, and that's something that is also, you know, the regulations associated with those plans and how to manage them are also pretty detailed as well.
Something that the average person, the average business person, would really not be familiar with. How could they
That's
be?
That's correct.
Yeah. So that's your job, huh?
Yeah.
That's what you do.
And I love it. After almost 25 years, I'm still very much enjoying the practice of law, so... I don't know if everybody can say that about their job, but I can. That's nice.
The optimum would be, of course, to have these plans in place, whether it's an affirmative action plan or a corporate governance stipulations and so on and so forth. But in many cases, they're not in place. Would you ever be called in post-action, you know, where a former employee is suing, or a potential employee who didn't get a job is suing because of one of these things we've been talking about?
Absolutely. And in fact, I think often a scenario like that will give rise to, after sort of handling that particular employee's claim and working through those issues in whatever way that needs to happen, whether it's in litigation or whether you're able to resolve the issues, it's often at that point that you end up putting these policies and procedures in place, or updating ones that were in place but hadn't been updated to reflect changes in the law.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that we absolutely very much get involved in.
Classic case of locking the barn door after the horse is gone, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But then you say at least, you know, maybe one horse got away, but the rest of the ones in the barn, you want to keep them in there and make sure that, that things are handled better for them.
One thing that you had mentioned earlier that comes into play here, you mentioned common sense. Ethics comes into play as well, does it not?
Absolutely.
In corporate and commercial law?
Absolutely.
Ethics, or the lack thereof, I guess.
Well, I guess the comment I would make is all attorneys are bound by specific rules of ethics. I think every human being in their life is bound by their morals and their ethics, and that's ethics with a certain context and a certain meaning. But again, with specific to the practice of law, again, there are very specific rules of ethics that all lawyers are bound to follow. And in fact, to maintain your law degree every year, you have to have 12 hours of continuing legal education. And it's 1 or 2 hours of which need to be ethics, so updating and ongoing training on the rules of ethics. And that would be, for example, address issues of confidentiality. I mean, that is something of preeminent importance in the attorney-client relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Conflicts of law, or conflicts in relationships, meaning you can't represent people that have adverse interest to each other. You can't represent somebody on one hand and then a month later be suing them, right? If you have an attorney-client relationship, there's a duty of ongoing duty, not only of confidentiality, but again, because of the conflict rules, you can't.
We sometimes hear of a judge recusing himself or herself from a case. Do attorneys do that occasionally too, or should they?
Absolutely. Attorneys do that all the time. This is along the lines of what folks may not know happens, but anytime you are considering representing either a current current client on a matter, on a new matter, or a new matter, you have to run a conflict check with your firm. That is, you make sure that there isn't somebody else in the firm that's representing somebody that has an interest adverse to that potential client. So you can't even take on the relationship unless you've been able to clear what we call a conflicts check.
So. What about compliance issues for companies? Do you help businesses deal with that?
Yes, I do. And often I've been brought in to do sort of an employment compliance evaluation. Although, you know, our firm does compliance work in a whole wide range of issues. One thing I had done in the past was export control compliance. And that's if there's production of defense-related articles or anything where there's military components, there's a whole wide range of export control laws that need to be put in place. So one thing I like to do, not only review contracts and make sure that the terms accurately reflect the party's intention, there is something I find exciting about getting a good process in place, one that complies with the law, but then is also articulated in a way that folks can actually follow it and comply.
And this would apply for, you know, we have a lot of high-tech, cutting-edge manufacturing firms here now in our region, and not just Butler County, but all of Western Pennsylvania, and they do export a lot of these high-technology components, and that's a factor.
It is.
Particularly when you're talking about defense-related issues, parts that might be used in weapons, right?
And I think this is a great example of something where you don't know what you don't know sometimes, and companies who would never want to be put our country in harm's way in any way, or wouldn't want to be working with somebody that doesn't have our country's best interests at heart. If they don't have a good, they may not realize that they're working with somebody that they shouldn't be working with if they don't have an export control compliance program in place, or they're actually checking the names on, the Department of Defense and the Department of Commerce have lists. There's 17, 19 different lists of bad actors or countries with whom you can't do business. The State Department keeps that list in place, and it's imperative to ensure that if you are doing anything that could be defense-related, that you are making sure you're in compliance in verifying all those lists, that you're not accidentally working with an enemy of the country.
I'm guessing that Iran and North Korea would probably be on that list right now.
Absolutely.
Among others. Well, those are the obvious ones. But as you said, there may be innocent mistakes made.
Right.
You
know,
some
right.
companies that don't realize they're not in compliance.
Right.
So you have to check that kind of stuff. Huh?
Absolutely. In fact, I'm thinking of there was a small company in Arkansas that made these little electrical components and really had no idea that it was being used by one of these country's enemies for mines. So, again, good to make sure that you've got a program in place.
We're chatting once again with Delia Bianchin, a local attorney with the Lynch Law Group. Her focus for her entire legal career has been on commercial and corporate law and employment law. What about companies preparing or revising employee handbooks. Do you get involved in counseling them in that area?
Absolutely. I do a lot of that work, actually. And again, sometimes a company may not have one at all. This is another opportunity to just provide good, clear guidance to your employees about what your expectations are. And to, it kind of operates as a check for the company as well to ensure that they know what they're required to do. You know, I'll just flag for you one area, paid time off or vacation pay, sick time. That's an area where, for example, the law doesn't require that you offer such benefits to your employees. But if you do, it's absolutely imperative that you're consistent in the way that you apply those benefits. So you can't pick and choose. You can't have one person is able to, for example, roll their vacation over from one year to the next, but another employee can't. You know, you need to make sure those policies are consistent. And again, a lot of times handbooks may address some of the issues that you might face with respect to paid time off policies, but it doesn't address all of them. Mm-hmm. And again, the revisions we were talking about, if the horse gets out of the barn and then you're closing the doors, sometimes, you know, you end up making that revision after the fact, but then at least you've made it clear for the next scenario. But again, that's a really important tool that employers can use, and it's also incredibly helpful for employees that expectations be articulated in a clear way and that they clearly know what benefits they're entitled to, for example.
If you're starting from scratch, is there a generic template that you can use to start a handbook that you can get going and work from there?
A lot of times employers will have a version of a handbook, and you know, it may articulate things that are really specific and important to that company. So often I can just make adjustments to their existing policy. There are times where I might make a recommendation we should just start from scratch. You know, I rarely like to start with a blank page. I've been doing this long enough. I have a few forms that I like to start with.
Mm-hmm. Is it mandatory that every company be incorporated in Pennsylvania?
I think it's a good idea. When you ask the question, is it mandatory? You know, a company, in order for it to have its own identity, that is, for example, its own tax ID number, it does have to be incorporated. Mm. Otherwise, it's just the actions of the individuals that are running the company. So again, you might have a sole proprietor who doesn't incorporate, and there's nothing wrong with that, except for the fact that that person
doesn't that open,
may not be. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Well, again, I speak as a layperson here, obviously, but doesn't that open that person up to the possibility of, their personal finances being wiped out in a suit or something like that if they're not incorporated?
Absolutely. I was going to say it wouldn't be mandatory to be incorporated, but it would be my very strong...
Stupid not to.
You said that, but it would be my strong recommendation that you do take that step to protect your own personal assets. And again, the limited liability company format is something that can be a very helpful tool in that regard.
Now, this is what whenever you'll see this, those three letters after, company XYZ LLC, limited liability
company. Yep.
What exactly does that mean?
It's one of the form of it's a corporate entity form that means, which is different than a corporation, which would be have the INC or incorporated after it. The LLC is made up of members, and a company and corporation will have shareholders, right? So a limited liability company, you could have a sole member LLC or a multi-member LLC, and it operates and runs and functions by and through its members. And again, it affords a level of protection under the statutes for debts and liabilities of that entity, as long as certain precautions are taken. So So again, you need to make sure that you're operating the finances of that LLC separately. You're not commingling it with your own bank account.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of one of the classic examples.
Wondered about that. You see it a lot. In fact, you see it a lot more in recent years. And I, you know, as a layperson, I've always thought, well, what does that mean? You can't sue them for all they've got, or if they're limited liability, it's kind of convenient. You can only sue them for so much, yeah.
It essentially, as long as they have, as long as the protection remains intact, and there are certain scenarios where that could be broken, okay? As long as that protection remains intact, you can go after that entity for its assets, but not for the person that owns their assets. So again, it could operate as a protection of your own personal assets. A related issue that comes up is if you have a husband and wife that are co-owning a business, it's often our recommendation that you really have one or the other serve as the owner, so that in the event, and again, hopefully it's an unlikely event, that they call it piercing the corporate veil. Mm-hmm. That is, if you say we're not going to honor that there are, because of various facts and circumstances, we're going to say that the debt of the company should actually flow through to its individual members or owners. Under Pennsylvania law, it's one of seven jurisdictions where your marital assets would be protected, unless both the husband and the wife were members, in which case maybe that debt could be collected against them.
So better to just have one. Mm.
One example to think about is, we had a client who started a business and then incorporated, and had his most significant contract had been signed by him individually prior to having formed the business.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was an issue that came about relating to that contract. And because he had signed it in his individual name, the fact that he had the entity meant nothing, because it wasn't a contract with the entity. It was a contract with him individually. So the other thing I just want to throw out there is, in that scenario, that's okay if he already signed the contract before he signed the entity, but go back and amend the contract. Get it amended and say, I need that contract to be in the name of the entity.
What if the other person doesn't agree to that?
Well, it is a point of negotiation. So, but then at least maybe he would know, and he could take steps to provide, get additional insurance coverage or mm-hmm. something to help protect him.
We'll take a break. We'll continue our conversation with Delia Bianchin. On It's Your Turn on WISR. We will be back right after these words.
Tanglewood, your hometown center for entertainment, proudly presents the Skyliners. It's been 60 years since they topped the charts with Since I Don't Have You, but this famous Pittsburgh doo-wop group continues to thrill their fans. See the Skyliners live and in concert at Tanglewood, Saturday, August 10th. Doors open at 6, dinner buffet by Chef George at 7, showtime at 8. Only $35, and as always, it's BYOB. For tickets, call 287-0021.
Everyone's trying to beat the heat, so why bring it into your kitchen? There's no need to slave over a hot stove when you can go to Michael's Restaurant. They're cooking burgers, hoagies, pizzas, soups, and salads to feed the entire family. So relax, stay cool, and take the family to Michael's Restaurant, Route 422 in Butler.
Hi, this is Howie Pentney with Pentney Capital Management in Portersville. Today, many people need help managing their investments. The investment options available today can be confusing. If you would like to talk to someone for help, why not call me for an appointment? Howie Pentney at Pentney Capital Management, 1284 Perry Highway, Portersville, Pennsylvania. My telephone number is 724-368-4224. Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network. Member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome back. We're learning a lot. I'm learning a little bit. I hope you are too, listeners, about commercial and corporate law and employment law. We're very pleased to have local attorney Delia Bianchin with us here today from the Lynch Law Group in Cranberry. I'm talking about employment law now, Adelia. I can remember reading several years ago about flight attendants in the airline industry. And if you go back a few decades, it was always women who held that job. Now we have male and female flight attendants all the time. It's no big deal. But I remember reading that they were not allowed to get pregnant. And teachers, as I recall, at one time in many school districts, if they became pregnant, they had to quit their job. Remember those days? It's before our time, but I've read that it was true. That's certainly not the case anymore, I don't think, is it? I hope not.
It's absolutely not the case anymore. And, you know, that type of scenario is often what gives rise to another one of these employment-related statutes that have to come to be to address sort of a social concern. But there is the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, the Pregnancy PDA, that specifically prohibits discrimination of any sort based on pregnancy. And it's an interesting statute in a lot of ways. It mirrors or parrots a lot of the components to Title VII, which, again, I think we're more familiar with. It's been around for 50 years now. But the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, that's one area where sometimes just common sense may not be enough. And I guess what I'm talking about there is, you know, not the blatant type of discrimination you were describing, but sometimes there's a scenario employers can get in trouble where they're too protective of an employee for whom, you know, they know they're expecting a baby and they want to make decisions that can be viewed as paternalistic about that person. And the case law and the statutes and the regulations are very clear that that is not prohibited. I mean, that's not permitted. It is prohibited.
It could be too protective.
Yep. Yep. You can't just decide, you as the employer can't decide what that employee can and can't do.
Oh, okay.
It is up to that employee to say whether or not they're able to continue to do their job. So, for example, if you're a waitress, the employer can't say, well, I don't think you can continue to do this job right now because of your pregnancy, and say, take them off the floor and, you know, have them do other work where, for example, they may not make as much because they're not getting tips. That would be one example. Or in the manufacturing environment, that comes up as well. You know, they say, well, we're going to take you off this particular job because, you know, we don't think that you can perform the job. Well, it's up to that employee and that employee's doctor and their medical, you know, the employee is the one that gets to decide whether or not that's what they can continue to perform the functions of their job.
Is it mandatory that a woman be accepted back at her job after she's had a child?
Yes. Yep. And that operates very similar and in conjunction with FMLA, the Family Medical and Leave Act, which specifically regulates that type of protection. Really for any employee who has medical issues and is out for a period of time, you're afforded what's called job protection for like 12-week period, where after that point in time, the company is required to put you back in that job if it's still available or a similar position. It's going to be very fact-specific. I think we made some comments early on about, you know, there aren't usually hard and fast rules. Again, often the particular facts and circumstances are going to play an important part. But, yeah, absolutely. No longer are they going to be able to say teachers can't have kids, like you said. Or
Is it mandatory that women get family leave after having a child in Pennsylvania?
You are entitled to be allowed to take up to 12 weeks of leave. Absolutely. Now, and after that point in time, again, the company is obligated to put you back in that same or a similar position.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, there might be facts and circumstances that you may not get your exact same job back, but to the extent that there is a position still available or accommodations can be made, the employer is obligated to do that.
I've read where some states are looking toward parental leave for a period for the father as well.
Yeah. Paternity policies are becoming more and more popular. They've been around for a while. And what I should specify is that leave, whether or not that leave is paid, is sort of the developing issue. At this point, there's no requirement that that leave be a paid leave. Again, often it works in conjunction with your paid time off policy or your vacation policy. Often employers will say you, when you're out on your leave, you have to use up your vacation. But maybe they're going to say you don't have to use up your vacation. That's one of those points I was talking about before. Mm-hmm. The employer needs to decide and then apply it consistently. But there is a trend towards with employers offering that that leave be paid, at least in part, you know, maybe at a certain percentage of your pay, and maybe just for a period of time of that leave. But again, that is something that's an area that's developing, and like you said, extending to fathers as well.
I saw a story on the wire. It's within the past couple of weeks, but I'm struggling to remember the exact details. I'll give it a go. I don't have it in front of me right now, but it seems to me that it referred to the now-defunct Pittsburgh Press newspaper in Pittsburgh, which, of course, went out of business 15, 20 years ago, something like that. But they used to, in their want ad section, they would list jobs under the heading Men Wanted or Women Wanted. And as I recall, they were sued for that. And they ended up having to go to non-gender-specific want ads.
Yeah.
So I guess this is another area where you never know. Huh?
Exactly. And, you know, I think in general, with respect to any protected class, we were talking about age earlier, gender, sex. If it's not a specific requirement of the job, and then it always raises that question, should it be a requirement of the job?
Yeah.
You know, even if it's your first instinct that you think that a male is the one that would fill that position, if that's not really a legitimate consideration, then you're not entitled to pursue that. I'm wondering if you, if you had an affirmative action plan, whether under some scenario you could say there was a preference for that, though quite frankly my advice would just be to reference that you were had an affirmative action plan in place.
Times have changed. I mean, it wasn't all that long ago when you could, you know, if you're looking for a professional wrestler, that would always be a guy, but that's not the case anymore. They got the women wrestlers on TV now. I have a couple of more questions on employment law. I need to take a final break, though, so let's do that, and we'll be back to wrap up our conversation with Delia here on It's Your Turn on WISR, back right after these words.
Summer may be coming to an end soon, but at Osterling's Lawn and Garden, they're already preparing for fall gardening. There's still time to plant lettuce, peas, radishes, turnips, and onions. New bird baths are also in stock, and check out all the amazing items for your pets, including both hemp joint and hemp calming soft chews for cats and dogs. And don't forget flea and tick collars, traps, and sprays. They have it all, from bone-eyed Japanese beetle traps to Mrs. Wage's salsa and pickle mixes at Osterling's Lawn and Garden, Monroe Street in Butler.
I'm Dr. Megan Miller, a primary care sports medicine specialist at Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers. Whether it's a 5K or a full marathon, runners are as active as ever in these summer months. As a runner myself, I know how to treat the specific injuries, sprains, and strains you may experience on your journey. You can count on me to provide top-notch sports medicine care and get you back to doing what you love. For more information or to schedule an appointment, please visit TriRiversMSK.com or call 1-866-874-7473.
Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us. We're going your way, getting there starts here. Just hop the bus, easy and economical. Just hop the bus, no car, no problem. The bus will get you there, 'cause that's what we do. Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way.
chatting with Delia Bianc and local attorney with the Lynch Law Group. I had a couple of other questions about employment law. I think these are of general interest to people. What about criminal background checks whenever you're considering hiring a person? Can somebody refuse those? Is it strictly the purview of the company, the potential employer, to request that? What's the law on that?
So this is it's interesting, Dave, that you asked about this. This is an area where there is some change in development recently. And it used to be sort of standard for employers to just run a criminal background check as part of the normal hiring process. There's some pushback with the regulators, particularly at the federal level, that have found sort of a discriminatory impact to having those requirements, those background checks done as a matter of course. And what the requirements are is that there's a closer look, there's more deliberation about whether or not that background check is required for the position at issue. So there is some pushback. An employee has, an applicant, mm-hmm. has the right to know in advance that the company is going to be running a background check.
And they can refuse or say, no thanks, I don't want to be considered, or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess part of the reason why you have the right to be notified that the company is intending to run a criminal background check is maybe you say, I know they're going to find something, and I'm going to just choose not to apply. So, yes, there has to be notice provided. And then this is something that employers don't always know either, but if the employer finds something in that criminal background check, that gives them rise of concern and based on which they want to make a decision not to hire that person, you have to provide that employee what's called an adverse action notice letter. So you have to provide them with notice about what you found and that you're going to be taking that action to give that applicant an opportunity to object. Now, the reasons for the objection are very limited. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's mistaken identity. Yeah, we were joking earlier with my name, Delia Biancan. I don't get too many people that get confused with my name, but, you know, that can happen. And
what about drug testing? I see so many advertisements for jobs these days, and that'll be the last phrase, drug testing required. Can potential employers, in fact, require that? Is that legal?
Absolutely. Yeah, and I would say most particularly in the manufacturing environment where safety is very much an issue. And quite frankly, drug testing is something that, again, employers do have the right to conduct. Now, it's important to have a policy. Again, we've spoken about employee handbooks and employee policies. It's good to have a policy in place. And to be sure that the employer is handling that testing, you know, in accordance with the way the regulations require. Again, employees have the right to know that they could be subject to drug testing, so that's important to make sure they have notice. And again, with random drug tests, again, you want to make sure if the employer wants to conduct those that employees have notice. And, you know, the employer has to have, if it's not a random drug test or it's not all employees being tested, then you have to have a basis, a reason for having concern about asking for a test.
That all has to be spelled out. I know this is not corporate, I don't think, but there are a number of school districts in the area now that have random drug testing, but in all cases it's limited to students who decide to participate in certain extracurricular activities or in some schools who want to drive their own car to school. So they have limits set up. And if you don't want to be subjected to random drug testing, then don't participate in those particular activities.
And I would imagine if not all instances, most instances, that child and that child's parents have signed a form providing consent for that testing so that they are made aware and the school district has record of that.
It's complex, these regulations. That's why people like you exist, right?
Exactly. And what I love to do is try to make concepts that are complex as straightforward as possible. Even from, I remember teaching a class, helping to teach a class in law school called Plain English for Lawyers, which sometimes we tend to get, we can get very verbose or complex in the way contracts are drafted.
Legalese is the term that most of us would use. Well, I certainly appreciate you enlightening us. You've certainly enlightened me, so I enjoyed our conversation today.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity.
Local attorney Delia Bianken is with the Lynch Law Group. If you want to get in touch with her, you're in the Cranberry office, right?
Yes.
Of the, the Lynch Law Group. And what's the address there?
It's 501 Smith Drive, Cranberry Township.
Terrific.
Right there in the Cranberry Professional Park. And we just got a new sign outside the building, so you really can't miss it.
Delia, nice to meet you. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, among other guests, Tom Knights, Butler Township Manager, will be here to talk with us. We'll have some other guests for you as well, including an update from the American Cancer Society on how Pennsylvania measures up in their annual survey of legislation to help prevent the incidence of cancer. We'll do that tomorrow as well. Hey, enjoy the fine weather the rest of this Thursday, and hope you can be with us tomorrow for the Friday edition of It's Your Turn.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 12:30 to 1:30, right here on WISR 680.
Baby, it's so far away. Well, there's a road.